The next area that I want to talk about is handling disagreements. And Gerald, as he said a little bit earlier, rule number one, you know, let them be few and far between, right? Yeah, let them be few and far between. But it is true that disagreements are inevitable in marriage, that we're going to see the world differently just because we're men and women. We just have a different way of looking at things. And we're wired differently as individuals. You know, I am by nature a person who tends to act first and think later. I tend to be a little bit more on the impulsive side, and Janine tends to be the kind of person that wants to get a whole lot of information about something before action is taken, and that sometimes creates a little bit of tension in our relationships. So that's one thing we've had to learn how to navigate in our relationship. You also have the factor that spouses were raised with different philosophies. Like, the way I was raised as a kid is very different than the way Janine was raised as a child. My parents had a completely different approach to parenting than her parents did. So that means, as we've been parenting our children, we've kind of had to work our way through some disagreements about parenting philosophy. And then you have all of these factors. You've got different insecurities, childhood traumas that sometimes we have to deal with, generational baggage. All of these things create complexity and tension in the relationship. But I want to make a very clear point. It's one thing to disagree, but it's a whole other thing to fight. And I do see a difference between fighting and disagreeing. Fighting, I believe, is unloving. And by fighting, what I mean is your objective is to win the argument. Your objective is to dominate. You are the one who wants to walk away having had your way in the conversation. That's a fight. And I believe fighting is unloving. Just going to the very basic definition of love in 1 Corinthians 13, love is not provoked. Love does not pick a fight. Love is not drawn into a fight. In that same passage, love is not exasperated. It doesn't allow disagreements to escalate to a destructive end. Love does not behave rudely. It seems to me that you can disagree with someone politely, but fighting, it typically implies a level of rudeness. Fighting is unloving, and fighting ultimately will hurt a relationship. But what we're talking about today isn't fighting. We're talking about disagreements. Moments when you're having trouble seeing eye to eye, not because you want to win or he or she wants to win, but because you just can't quite get this thing settled. The first thing I want to emphasize is these things need to be settled between the two of you. One thing Janine and I agreed on very early in our marriage is we were not going to seek third parties basically for anything. Advice, mediation of disputes, nothing. We agreed that we were just going to settle these things between ourselves and hammer these things out without the help of others. And I have found that to be very good in the long run for both of us. And I say that because of what Jesus teaches in Matthew 18:15, like we talked about this morning. These one another commands, these commands that guide our relationship with fellow Christians, apply to marriage. And Jesus says, if you have a disagreement with someone, with your brother or sister, go to them one-on-one, tell them their fault as you see it, air your disagreement with them, work it out with them. Don't involve other people. And I've just run into too many cases where you have spouses that want others just to come in and fix the situation for them. And I just don't think that that is what's best. Jesus teaches this also in Luke chapter 17, verse number 3. Take heed to yourselves. If your brother sins against you, rebuke him, and if he repents, forgive him. So I just this is my own personal point of view. I know there may be other points of view out there, and I'd be glad to hear them, but I think it's just best for married people to take their disagreements to one another and not to get anyone else involved. Mom or dad, grandpa, grandma, no one. No, the two of you just settle these things between one another. Now, there may be situations where marital counseling might help you. I don't want to dismiss that possibility, but I think by and large, these things can and should be worked out between the two of you. That's my personal philosophy and conviction. But if you seek outside counsel for your marriage, this would be what I would advise. Seek the outside counsel for yourself and not your spouse. This kind of goes back to something I said this morning, which is there's only two people who can fix your spouse, them and the Lord Jesus Christ. And what I have found is people who go to marriage counseling tend to want the marriage counselor to fix what's wrong with the partner in the marriage rather than themselves. So this, to me, just kind of goes back to this fundamental assumption that if there's a problem in the marriage, I'm the one who needs to tend to my part of it. So if you go get advice, if you seek outside counsel, I'm sorry, I'm kind of talking ahead of my slides here. If you seek outside counsel and you do so because you want to fix your spouse, I think that's just going to create more problems in the marriage. If you need advice, seek it for yourself. Because a lot of times, if you go to outside counsel, what you're looking for is justification for your actions or your point of view. I'm right and they're wrong. You're looking for validation. You're not actually looking for solutions. Now, that's not entirely true. So I'm just saying, check your heart. Look at your heart. Check your motivations. Make sure that if you do seek advice from elsewhere, make sure it's for the right reasons. Make sure you're focusing on how you can improve the situation by changing your own conduct. Any questions or comments on that? Some of that may be a little controversial. I don't know. That's just my own philosophy. Keep moving? Okay. So when you come to a deadlock, when you can't arrive at an agreement on something, how do you break it? Well, first of all, remember, there are no easy exits, right? If you're hung up on something, you can't hit the eject button. As we talked about this morning, all those passages about divorce, there's no easy way out. So as Paul Newman said, people stay married because they want to, not because the doors are locked. You know, Paul Newman's kind of an interesting character. I think he may have been one of the few people in Hollywood that had a long and happy marriage. I think, as I recall, he and his wife were married for like maybe more than 40 years, I want to say. Anyways, he's got some really good advice about marriage, actually, which kind of is strange. You wouldn't think that coming out of a Hollywood person, but I like this quote because it's a reminder. You stay in marriage because you want to. So if you hit a point where you cannot reach an agreement, just remember, there's no easy exit. And maybe the solution is just to take a break for a little while. So we have all kinds, well, not all kinds, but we have a few examples in the Bible of people who went their separate ways for a time because of some disputes. Abraham and Lot went their separate ways, Jacob and Laban, Paul and Barnabas. I remember I gave this class one time at a congregation, and a brother shared this story about his grandparents. He noticed that when his grandparents had a disagreement, his grandpa would go to the garden and his grandma would get down on her hands and knees and start scrubbing the floor. And that happened often enough that he noticed a pattern there. And after a little while, after grandpa had spent time in the garden and grandma had spent time scrubbing the floor on her hands and knees, one of them would come to the other and they would resolve the conflict. I thought that was kind of an interesting way of approaching this problem. So maybe a few minutes, a few hours, or a day to cool off, to clear the air. That may be all that's needed. And by that, I don't mean like leaving. I just mean put it on the shelf. Leave it for later. Give it time to breathe. Give both of yourselves time to think about it. But if you do that, make sure you agree upon that. Because one of the danger signs in disagreements is when someone walks away. That's a way of avoiding the conflict. That's a way of manipulating the situation. If you decide that you're not going to reach an agreement and you need to take some time, say, one of you say to the other, look, I think we just need to put this on the shelf for a couple hours, a day, a two. Let's come back to this after a break. And if you both can agree upon that, then take a break. Now, your spouse may not feel the same way, right? They may be like, look, we need to sort this out. We need to come to some sort of resolution. I'm just saying that maybe there are instances where it would be good to take a little time to cool off, but make sure you both agree that that is the right thing to do. And if you do decide to take a break, here's one thing you should be doing while you're in that break. Spend time in prayer. This passage isn't exactly about this particular problem, but remember in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, when Paul talks about spouses taking some time away from intimacy, what does he say to do while they're taking some time away? To dedicate themselves to prayer and fasting, right? So maybe taking this time away, you can just mutually agree, look, I'm going to go pray about this. Why don't you pray about it? Let's get together in a few hours once we've talked with God, once we've asked him for wisdom, and let's revisit this. And when you pray, I just want to encourage you, be completely transparent with God. Like, lay it all out there. Tell him exactly how you feel, because you're not hiding it from him. He knows how you feel. He can see your heart. He can read your mind. He knows exactly how you feel. Be completely transparent with him. Ask him to help you overcome those feelings of frustration. Ask him for wisdom and discernment. And also, if you've reached loggerheads, take time to pray for your spouse. And it's amazing. If you've had a little disagreement with one another, and you might have some feelings there, if you take the time to pray for them, to thank God for them, for all of their good qualities, that can help kind of clear out some of the cobwebs and the mush that's up there in your brain. Ask God to help heal you and to help you change your heart. These are the sorts of things that I think are really helpful in these moments when we can't quite reach an agreement. I'm a big believer in this. You're probably tired of me saying it, but I'm going to say it one more time. Make sure you take time for self-evaluation. That's what Jesus teaches in Matthew chapter 7, verses 1 through 5, when he talks about specks in the eye versus beams in the eye. A lot of times, we reach these deadlocks because we're not really looking at our own beams, right? We're so focused on the speck in our spouse's eye that we haven't really stepped back to take into consideration, what are the big things I'm missing? What am I not hearing? What is he or she saying to me that I'm not hearing or taking into consideration? You know, one thing that Janine's grandpa said in our marriage ceremony that stuck with me is, people who love one another can hurt one another more. And he knew that firsthand. He had a very difficult marriage to his second wife. So he knew how much married people could hurt one another. And the closer you get with someone, the easier it is to be harsh and critical. You know their buttons. You know their weak points. You can really exploit those. But it's really important in these moments to pay attention to those beams. Make sure you're looking at the beams in your own eye rather than the speck in your spouse's eye. And I'll share with you a story from a sister at the church on J Street. She's gone on to her reward, So I think I can go ahead and talk to you about her by name. Her name was Helen. I don't know if a lot of you met her. She joined the church later on in the church's existence. In fact, it may have been after they moved from the J Street location and became Jefferson Avenue. She started visiting the church, and John Morris and I, John had the oversight. We went over to visit her one day. And we were talking with her, getting to know her. She had been in Colorado Springs for most of her life, and she had moved up to Jefferson Avenue. And we were asking her, you know, did you know the church at Cedar and Cimarron? And no, she had gone to a different church in Colorado Springs. And she just came right out and said this. And I've always admired her, this candid moment. She said, "My husband and I made a mistake with our kids. We did not raise them as we should have, and they've all left the church because of it." That was an amazingly brave moment. And I've always held her in high esteem for that, because there's not many people who would be that transparent about their feelings. And I bring that example up not because it necessarily has anything to do with handling disagreements with your spouse, but that level of honesty, that level, that willingness to accept responsibility, that's the sort of thing that helps marriages improve. So if you can just be that honest with each other and honest with yourself, look at your beams rather than your spouse's specs, that helps quite a bit. Always remember that in disagreements, both parties are a little bit right and a little bit wrong, right? All of us have a little bit of weakness to our argument. All of us have a little bit of strength. And I think it's important for us to listen to what our spouse is saying and acknowledge, hey, there's truth in this and this and this in what she's saying, and I need to take that into consideration. And if you find yourself at fault, own it. Accept it. Don't dwell on the faults you see in your spouse. That's just poison for a marriage. Focus on your own faults. Admit your faults. Ask them for forgiveness if you think it's appropriate in the moment. Whatever's necessary, just be willing to acknowledge your own weaknesses. One of the passages that I really love is over in James chapter 3, verse 17. I referred to this with the men a little bit earlier. But the wisdom that is from above that James talks about in chapter 3, verse 17, this is a great way to reach a peaceable conclusion. The wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. When you find yourself in a disagreement with your spouse, it's good to just kind of walk through this checklist. Like, am I pure? Like, am I completely in the right here? Is my position as right or as righteous as I might be inclined to think that it is? Am I pure? Am I being peaceable? Do I really want to be at peace with my spouse, or am I more interested in being right? Kind of back to the whole difference between a fight and a disagreement. Am I gentle? You know, this is something that I think men in particular need to take into consideration, but, you know, women can have they can have a roughness too as well. Am I being gentle in this disagreement? Am I willing to yield, right? Am I willing to give way? Am I willing to acknowledge that maybe my way of seeing things isn't exactly right and my spouse has a point? Am I willing to yield? Am I showing mercy? And by that, I just simply mean, am I willing to overlook whatever specks I see in my spouse's eye and take into consideration where I'm at? Am I showing him or her mercy? And is there anything good to gain from this disagreement? This is something Bill, as we were getting ready to get into this, Bill just said something like, the older you get, the less you find to fight about. And that's just true in life, I think, that the farther along in life you go, the less really there is that you feel is worth fighting for, might be the best way to put it. And that's certainly true in marriage, I think. That sometimes the things that may have been important 10, 15, 20 years ago just aren't important anymore. So can anything good be gained from this disagreement? So what I'm driving toward here is, if we have a disagreement, our objective isn't necessarily to agree with one another, but our objective is to find peace. Can we find a peaceable solution? Maybe that means adopting the perspective of your wife or your husband or vice versa. You may not necessarily agree, but can you be at peace with one another? In Romans chapter 14, Paul talks about how Christians don't always see the same issue the same way. We have different points of view on these matters, and we don't see issues the same way. Some disagreements, even among Christians, can't be settled. So what Paul's teaching us in Romans 14 is, can you find a way to tolerate one another, to live with a degree of disagreement? And can you respect each other's point of view and avoid placing stumbling blocks? And as he sums up his argument, I think verse number 19 is perhaps the crucial verse in the entire chapter. Therefore, let us pursue the things which make for peace and the things by which one may edify another. And this kind of goes back to something that Gerald said before we got started. Is this really going to make for peace? Is this really that important? And is peace with my spouse more important than settling this area of disagreement? Our objective is peace. Have we heard one another out? Do we understand where the other one is coming from? Can we reach some sort of peaceful compromise? Are we both committed to finding a way to get along with one another? As James says, the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So work toward peace. That's the ultimate objective. You may not see eye to eye, but can you be at peace with one another? Make that your aim. The last area I've got to cover today is, how do we navigate external hardships as a couple? And by external hardships, I mean things that happen outside of our marriage. So we've got disagreements that happen within the marriage. Well, what about things outside the marriage? How do we navigate those waters? As a cautionary tale, I bring to your attention Job's wife, who probably did not handle this the right way, right? When Job found himself in this pretty desperate state, she asked him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. What Job is able to say to his wife is, you're not seeing the full picture. You're only seeing a part of this. And from Job's perspective, good things come from God and bad things come from God as well. Now, as you go through the book of Job, one of the things you learn is what they understood about God and how he operated was flawed. I don't think Job was aware that Satan was the one who was responsible for all of these terrible things that happened to him. I think that's put in the book later on, maybe by Moses, maybe by another prophet who put this book into writing. I don't think Job fully understood his situation, why things happened to him, and I'm fairly certain as I read through the book that he and his three friends did not have a good understanding of how God operates. But I do appreciate what he has to say here, which is, you're not understanding this situation as you should. Adversity happens in life, good happens in life. That's just the way the world works. And I think that serves as a useful starting place. When bad things happen, to you, to your family, it's good just to frame them within a proper understanding of why bad things happen. So in other words, this bad thing has happened. Let's figure out why it's happened. Sometimes it's because of the consequences of sin. Either you have sinned or your spouse has sinned and you're paying the consequences. Galatians chapter 6, verse 7, do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. This, of course, is what is sometimes called the law of sowing and reaping. And, you know, we can't fool God. We might be able to fool other people. We might even be able to fool our spouse for a time. But hidden sin, secret sin, has a way of catching up with us. And there will be consequences to pay. And sometimes those consequences can be quite severe. You've got the cause, sin, and you've got the consequence, which is the effect. And one of the problems in the book of Job is they very much believed in the concept of karma. Bad things only happen to bad people. That's why Job's three friends spend all this time trying to convince Job that he really is secretly a wicked, unrighteous man. They very much believed in the idea of karma. But what Paul is teaching is a cause-effect relationship. I sin and there is a consequence. I remember one friend told me he and his wife had been struggling for a while, and he had sought out various people for advice. And he went to his dad and explained what was going on to his dad. And his dad looked at him and said, well, the two of you got yourselves into this situation, and the two of you will get yourselves out of it. And I appreciated that perspective, that they had made decisions for which they were paying consequences. And they were in a difficult set of circumstances because of those decisions. And his advice was, you made the mistakes together, now you got to work your way out of it together. So that, I think, is something we've got to bear in mind. Sometimes our trials are of our own making. So blaming the other spouse isn't going to work. Taking personal responsibility, working together to get through it, those are the sorts of things that need to be done. Now, the really troubling ones are when one spouse is guilty of sin and the other spouse is having to pay the consequences for those sins. That's really hard to work through. We'll talk about that here in just a moment. In James chapter 5, verses 1 through 6, James talks about how the rich had taken advantage of the poor by not paying them the wages that were due to them. They had denied them their wage. And James's message is, look, God's paying attention. He is going to avenge the poor person. The reason I bring this up is because this is an example of how sometimes we suffer in life because of what other people do to us. Sometimes we pay the consequences for the sins of others. Sometimes that happens in a marriage. One spouse makes a huge mistake, commits a sin, and the other spouse is forced to pay for those consequences. Outsider perspective. Sometimes people outside of the family do things to our family. And it's good for us to remember that when bad things happen to us that are the result of other people's actions, it's good for us to remember that everyone has free will, even those who will use it to inflict harm on innocent victims. I remember talking with a man one time who some terrible things had happened to him as a child. And one of the things he had a hard time getting past was, how did God allow this person to do this to me? And what was able to help him ultimately was coming to the understanding that that person who had perpetrated this terrible sin against him, that person had the same gift of free will that he did. And God allows us all to make choices. even choices that hurt others. You think about Ahab and Jezebel hunting down and executing the prophets. You think about Pilate executing Galileans while they worshiped. You think of Jesus, who was betrayed, falsely accused, and executed. All these are examples of what others do to us. And sometimes you find yourself having to deal with things that have been done to your spouse or to your children by others, sometimes even in the church, and it's very difficult to work through. Very difficult, but it's always good to make sure you're approaching this with the right understanding, that this bad thing is happening because this person had a choice, and just like me, they chose to use it poorly. Just like I do from time to time, I choose to sin. So keeping that in mind does help to a certain degree, but I'm not pretending for a moment that these things aren't difficult. Of course, you have the famous passage in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verses 11 and 12 about time and chance. And this passage, I think, is terribly comforting because sometimes you can't explain the bad things that happen because of sin, either yours or someone else's. There's just no rhyme or reason why things happen. We live in an unpredictable world, as Solomon says. Job's children were crushed in a house collapse during a windstorm. Now, of course, we know from what a later prophet told us that Satan was responsible for that windstorm, but did Job know that at the time? All he knew was that a windstorm knocked down this house and crushed all of his kids. Jesus talks about a tower falling in Luke chapter 13, verse 4, and killing a bunch of people. King Josiah was struck by an arrow in battle, even though he was disguised. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Time and chance happen to us all. And that happens in marriage, too. This terrible thing happens, and you just think, why? Why us? Well, we just live in an unpredictable world. And sorry, my mind's kind of going through some examples I could give, and I want to be careful here because Janine and I haven't discussed any specific examples, so I want to be careful that I, what I say. Yeah, I'll just leave it at that. Last thing here. There's two more things. Revelation chapter 21, verses 3 and 4. Here's another reason why bad things happen. And this seems like this is actually a good thing, right? This is talking about heaven, about God wiping away all tears from their eyes. And this is just a reminder that sorrow and suffering and tough times are just a part of living in this world. That that's just the way things are going to go. That God has subjected the world to futility. That he has allowed these things to happen. That corruption and decay are a consequence of humanity's sin. This is a realm of sickness and death. I talked about this morning about this being the 15th anniversary of my mom's death. Why did mom die at the age of 58? Well, she got cancer. She got cancer because cancer's in the world. Cancer's in the world because Adam sinned and everybody else after him has sinned, right? Except for one man. That's just the way this world goes. You think of people like Tom Woody and all that Tom suffered. We've got a brother up at Kirksville right now who's been battling liver cancer for 10 years. 10 years! And he's been down to MD Anderson probably half a dozen times. And the doctors down there look at him and they've said more than one time, "We don't know how you're alive. It's just because of faith." So here's this good man. He's got this terrible disease, and you wonder, well, why couldn't that happen to somebody worse? Well, it's because we're in this world. It's a part of this world. And that's something that we as married couples just have to accept, that as hard as we work to protect our families, as hard as we try, there are some things we cannot spare one another from. All right, I will turn this off. Peter in 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 8 and 9, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world." It's good to remember that sometimes Satan is the one responsible for what you're going through. There are times where Janine and I have looked at each other, and there's been a series of things that have happened, completely unrelated to one another, but all hitting at the same time. Anybody else been through times like that? And it feels almost coordinated, like there's someone pulling the strings. And my personal conviction is when those moments happen, I think Satan is at work. That's my personal conviction. That when it seems like there's something conspiring against you, when things are happening that could be dismissed as coincidental, maybe it's not. Maybe this is a time of testing. And I believe that because of Job, right? Job gets slammed with the loss of his wealth, the loss of his children, the loss of his health, just bam, bam, bam. Was that all coincidental? No, it was Satan. Satan was at work. Jesus told Peter, "Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you like wheat." Paul says, "We do not wrestle against flesh and blood." I assume you all were talking about spiritual warfare this last month with John Morris. You probably talked about some of these things. That Satan and his demons are at work against us, even in our marriages. So you look at all the reasons why things can happen. And I do think it is helpful as a couple just to step back and say, all right, this is what's going on. This is why it seems these things are happening. So how do we face it? Well, you face it together. If the cause is us, what do? You fix it, right? If we're the cause, if there's something we are doing wrong or one of us is doing wrong, we fix it. If the cause is someone else, go confront them. If it's a situation where you're victims of time and chance, or you think Satan may be conspiring against you, bear it. This is a time of testing. You're going to learn. And Janine and I have looked at each other and just said, this is an opportunity to grow. This is an opportunity to grow. And if you both can walk into it with that kind of perspective, you can help each other through it. And in all these things, no matter what you're facing, the most important thing you can do is communicate. Talk to each other. Tell each other how you're feeling. Tell each other what you're suffering. And of course, talk with God. Tomorrow morning, if God's willing, when I speak, I'm planning to talk about God's healing and how God heals us through things like prayer. And there have been things that we have faced together in our marriage that the only way we have overcome them is by talking with one another and talking with God, period. There's no other way to overcome them. I heard a man one time who divorced his wife. He said, "You know, I used to think the problem was with my first wife, and now I've discovered that maybe that wasn't the problem at all." You know, it's the same attitude of the guy that, I don't know if you ever knew a guy like this in high school, maybe even college, who would date a bunch of women, and then he would complain about, well, what's wrong with women? And the common denominator was the dude, right? Maybe the problem isn't the women. Maybe you're the problem. And, you know, if you think things are going to be solved by getting out of this situation, you have no idea what kind of complications you're just creating for yourself. And the potential harm that you could do is so... I think that's one thing that people misunderstand about divorce in particular. When God says it covers one's garments with violence, what he's saying is it impacts people beyond you, your wife and your children. It has a cascading effect. And that's especially true in the church. There are divorces that happen in the church that affect people beyond those who are directly involved. Other questions, comments, thoughts as we draw to a close? God bless you, and God be with you, and God bless your marriages. So.